epidemiologically. So, of course, the question becomes, how does an excess of glucocorticoids set you up for a depression? And we've seen umpteen different things that glucocorticoids do. Amid the possible candidates, one is extremely interesting, which is truly sustained stress and truly sustained exposure to elevated glucocorticoid levels deplete dopamine from that dopamine reward pathway. And this is a direct possible link between major stress and the emergence of the anhedonia, the absence of pleasure, typical of major depression. This is a really important link. So commensurate with all of this, you wind up seeing elevated levels of glucocorticoids in a substantial subset of depressives. It can take the form of disappearing the daily rhythm, the circadian rhythm of glucocorticoid levels. The levels don't go down at the time of day they normally do. Other versions are the glucocorticoid system has trouble turning off at the end of stressors. It doesn't sense a negative feedback signal, that sort of minutia we talked about before. Elevated levels of glucocorticoids. And this supports this picture amid the psychomotor retardation. You can't get out of bed. You're so wiped out. Can't get out of bed because an enormous battle is going on internally. This notion of a depression as a chronic stress state, the notion, as we will see again, the notion of depression as anger turned inward. Okay, at this point, so you got something or other about the neurochemistry, you got something about the brain structure, you've got something about the endocrinology. At this point, you are practically a card-carrying biological psychiatrist at the cutting edge, the best there is out there. And at this point, if all you know about is the brain chemistry and the structure and the hormones, you're not going to be very good at curing depression. There's still going to be oceans of depressives out there who are not being helped. And to begin to put the pieces together, what we now have to do is transition from depression as a neurochemical, neuroanatomical, neuroendocrine disorder to looking at the psychological aspects of depression. And to begin to do so, God help me, very, very deep apologies here at this point, but I actually have to mention the name of Sigmund Freud. Because Freud had some remarkably insightful things to say about depression. Freud started off with the same puzzle we had in the last lecture. Hey, all of us get depressed, bad things happen to us, and we feel depressed and we heal. We come out the other end of it, and then there's the folks who bad things happen to, or even no bad things, and they crash into a deep clinical depression. Turn of the century Viennese term, mourning, something bad happens, you mourn and you come out the other end. Melancholia, something happens and you crash into a depression. And in this classic essay, Freud wrestled with the issue of what's the difference between mourning and melancholia, a reactive transient depression and a hugely impacting clinical one. And here's the scenario that he came up with, classically Freudian, with all of its possible things to criticize, but there is a kernel that just feels right in there. Okay, the core of Freudian thinking is individuals, objects, whatever, who you love, you also hate, ambivalence, confused feelings. In this Freudian view, depression comes out of a circumstance where you lose a loved object, person, idea, principle, who knows what, but you lose something, someone who you loved, and of course with the Freudian baggage coming along, who you also hated, and all that ambivalency stuff. What he posited was, in the aftermath of this loss, if you were able to put the angers, the hatreds, the resentments aside and focus purely on the sadness, the love, the loss, that's when you get mourning. That's where there's the sadness, the depression, and you recover, you heal, and you come out the other side. In the Freudian view, instead, what's going on in melancholia, you have these mixed feelings, the love, the hate, and you can't put the hate aside, and you are absolutely awash in the contradictions of the love, the hate, and the sheer force, the sheer crushing weight of this is what pushes somebody into melancholia. Okay, this isn't terribly scientific in modern terms, but something just feels right about this. When you look at this, no wonder there's so much grief. You lose a loved object, a loved individual, and you are able to put aside the ambivalencies, and you suffer one type of loss. You've lost this individual who you love. You have the mixed ambivalent state of Freudian confusion, and you lose a loved object, and you mourn two things. The first is the loss of that individual you love, and in addition, you have now lost the chance to ever make things better with them, to say the things you always wanted to hear them say or do whatever. It's a double loss. No wonder the grief is so much more severe. Next, the guilt. The guilt makes sense as well, which is you're sitting there in this Freudian froth there of ambivalency, and you loved this person, and you're sad, and you miss them. And at the same time, there's a part of you saying, thank God I can finally live my life now. How could you think a thing like that at a time like this? Guilt, paralyzing guilt coming in. More of the Freudian symptoms that begin to make sense, that psychomotor retardation. You were in the middle of this enormous emotional battle. You have this individual who you loved, you hated, you had mixed feelings, you wanted to say this and you never got to, and you wished they could have told you this, and you wondered if they really felt this way, and you just want, and now they're gone, and all you can do is take all that confusion and turn it inward, and no wonder you're too tired to get out of bed for weeks on end. This is where that Freudian soundbite of anger turned inward begins to make a lot of sense. So you see all these pieces, including at the extreme, the possibility of anger turned inward taking the form of self-injury. So this was the classic Freudian view. Doesn't make any sense in terms of modern biology. There's no way you can turn ratios of love-hate ratios to translate into estrogen-progesterone ratios or what ambivalencies look like in terms of norepinephrine. You can't do modern science on it. The best you can do is just have this intuitive sense it just feels right. Nonetheless, that's about all you can do with it. So what sort of psychology winds up being much more pertinent? And this is where we switch over to the world of psychological stressors. We already know by now what the key building blocks are: lack of outlets, lack of control, lack of predictability, perception that things are working, worsening, lack of social support. What a depression is about, in a sense, is a pathological extreme of those perceptions. And here's what you would see: a very disturbing research model with animals, but one, again, as you hear this, keep in mind, this is where Prozac came from, this is where tricyclics came from, this is where the next generation of antidepressants to treat the oceans of treatment-resistant depressives are going to come from. Here's the sort of model that's used. You take a rat, and you give it a shock every now and then. But it's set up in this contingent way where there's one side of the cage where the shocks come, the other side, the shocks don't come. And a little light comes on whenever there's going to be a shock here. And very quickly, the rat learns to shift over to this side. And the shock comes on this side, and the rat shifts over to that side. It masters this task fairly easily. Now, instead, take a rat where you just shock it. You just shock it without a warning, without any of this possibility of control. It just gets a lot of shocks. And now the next day, you put it into this setting where the light goes on here, you step over here, and you find the light goes on here, you learn to step over here, and the rat cannot learn to do it. It cannot learn this simple operancy, this simple bit of efficacy, this simple bit of control, because what have you done? The day before, with those repeated uncontrollable shocks, you've taught that rat to be helpless. And thus the soundbite in this realm of learned helplessness. And when you do this to animals like these experimentally, suddenly they get elevated glucocorticoid levels. Suddenly they've got problems with levels of norepinephrine, dopamine, all of that. Suddenly you have an animal who could be made less learned helpless with some antidepressant drugs. And what this has given rise to is this notion in cognitive psychology that what depression is learned helplessness. And this fits as well. This even begins to explain one of the pieces of the picture of depression, which is you have a child who loses a parent to death at a fairly early age, and for the rest of their life, they are more at risk for depression. This makes perfect sense. Think about this rat. The rat has learned when I'm in this cage and I'm getting those repeated shocks, there's nothing I can do about it. That's what the rat should have learned. Instead, what it learns is when I'm in any setting, even a setting where I could do something to seize control, even in a setting like that, I don't do it. I can't learn it. I don't perceive it because I've overgeneralized my helplessness into a cognitive distortion. What's going on with a kid? An awful lot of childhood is about learning what things you can control, what things you can't in the world out there, and what happens when you learn not only that there's things that you can't control, but some of them are so, so awful, you begin to learn in an overgeneralized way that you don't have a whole lot of control over anything. And what you're setting somebody up for is that same overgeneralization process, that cognitive distortion where instead of learning, this is a setting where I have no control, no predictability, no outlets, instead, this is what life is like. I am hopeless and I am helpless. This is a very powerful model. And this is one that I think gives us the most insight into the psychology of depression. It's the lecture on the psychology of stress writ large. Depression as caused by extremes of psychological stress. So now we've got two very different views. We've got the neurobiology end of it, hormones, brain chemicals, and we've got the experiential cognitive distortion, learned helplessness. How do you fit the pieces together? And here you begin to fit them together in an absolutely elegant way that's all built around stress. And what this involves is recognizing that depression is a genetic disorder. Depression has a certain degree of heritability to it. Depression runs in families. Oh, environment runs in families also. Much more careful studies showing things like identical twins have a higher rate of sharing a depressive trait than non-identical twins. Adoption studies, someone who is depressive is more likely to share that trait with their biological parents than with their adoptive parents. There's a genetic component to it. This is not, there is genetic determinism. Identical twins, one of them is depressed. There's about a 50% chance that the other one will get depressed also. A genetic fact. One of them has depression, there's a 50% chance that the other one won't get depressed. There's a genetic influence, there's not genetic determinacy. So what are the genes of depression all about? And a few years back, wonderful finding, fascinating one, by Avshalom Kaspi and colleagues at Duke University, isolating what appears to be one of the most meaningful genes related to depression. Where you look, and you look at large families that have patterns of depression and ones who don't, and you look for what genes are common to everybody with a depression and what genes are different from everybody, and out popped this one gene that was very interesting because it came with two different flavors, two different variants, and one of those variants seemed to be associated with the chemistry of depression. And part of what made people so excited was this gene made perfect sense. It would have been a drag if this turned out to be a gene that has something to do with like how many nostril hairs you have. What was this gene? It coded for the protein that removes serotonin from the synapse and recycles it, the serotonin transporter. And this gave rise to this landmark study looking at humans and looking at which type, which flavor of the serotonin transporter they had, and did this increase your risk of depression? This was a mammoth study focusing on tens of thousands of kids who they then followed for years afterward so that in early adulthood, you knew which ones already had signs of clinical depression, which ones don't, and you've genetically characterized them. So then the critical question of this entire literature, which is, so, if you had the, quote, bad version of the serotonin transporter gene, were you more likely to be clinically depressed? If you had the version that was more likely to produce the serotonin chaos that we now recognize to be central to depression, are you more likely to be clinically depressed? And back came the answer, which was no. Having that version of the gene did not increase your risk in the slightest. So what's going on there? Something much more subtle, something much more important. Having this version of the gene doesn't increase your risk of depression unless you also have had a lot of childhood stressors. In other words, an interaction here between early environment experience stress and genetic propensity. And what you see remarkably is for each increase in the childhood traumas, the folks with the good version of the gene have a little bit of an increased risk of depression. The folks with the bad version, it just increases more and more. This is a gene-environment interaction. This is the demonstration of how experiential trauma and stress interacts with the brain chemistry. And what is remarkable is it turns out glucocorticoids are able to do something to regulate this gene, the serotonin transporter gene. The pieces are perfect there. So what do we have at this point? We've seen the biological view of depression, and we've seen brain chemistry and hormones and anatomy and even genes. We've seen the more psychological one, Freudian theorizing, and for us, far more importantly, the notion of depression as pathological extension of psychological aspects of stress. And what we've seen, I think, most of all, is the utter intertwining of the two, and the intertwining, the interface being the role of stress. The role of stress as impacting the biology of depression, and the role of stress as an outcome of certain adverse aspects of your lives. And what this brings in is this absolutely critical point. We've had it starting with ulcers, and it pops up again and again. If all you try to do is understand the organic basis of a disease or the psychological, the psychosocial basis, you're not going to really know what's going on. It's at the intersection of the two that you get your most insight, and very, very frequently, that intersection is about stress.
Lecture 21, Anxiety, Hostility, Repression, and Reward.
By now, we've moved so far away from some of the themes that dominated the first part of this course. Way back when, what were we thinking about? Spastic colons and bladders and blood flow to penises and fat cells as inflammatory. And in the recent lectures, what we've done instead is move into the world of emotions and psychology and psychological stress. And as we saw in the last two lectures, the way in which psychological stress can bring about one of the worst of psychiatric disorders. What we'll be doing in this lecture is now shifting over to an additional realm, another realm of major stress having psychiatric implications. And what we'll shift to first is another one of the disastrous psychiatric disorders for which there's vast numbers of people suffering from it, arguably perhaps even more than the number of depressives, anxiety disorders. And as one prominent psychiatrist once described it, anxiety is the common cold of psychiatric disease. Now, a theme that came through very heavily in the depression lecture was you could think of depression as being a disease where people don't deal very well with stress, framed a particular way, which is when there's circumstances where you could control, where you have control, you have predictability, someone who's depressed is unable to find that. Someone who is depressed is unable to recognize there's the possible control and predictability. And this is the notion of learned helplessness. As we transition now to thinking about anxiety, you have another version of people not dealing well with stress. And in this case, it takes the form of these are people who perceive stressors, and what they do is they try to mobilize 14 different coping responses at once, and they're mutually contradictory, and they're endlessly vigilant, and most importantly, they can never recognize when it's over with. They can't recognize safety signals. It just goes on and on. Now, in beginning to understand the biology of anxiety, we enter a new part of the brain, one that hasn't really been mentioned before. After dwelling so much on the hippocampus, the hypothalamus, the cortex, frontal cortex, another part of the limbic system, an area called the amygdala. Now, the amygdala is absolutely central to understanding a lot of what goes wrong in anxiety. The amygdala plays a role in learning to be fearful of new things. It plays a role in innate fears and phobias. Very interestingly, the amygdala also plays a central role in aggression. In other words, you can't understand the neurobiology of aggression outside the context of the neurobiology of fear, and one might even conclude that in a world in which no amygdaloid neuron be afraid, you may perhaps have a more peaceful world centered around the amygdala. The amygdala is fascinating. And what you see is all sorts of evidence. If you stimulate the amygdala, you increase levels of anxiety, and this could be measured in a rat. If you destroy the amygdala experimentally, you decrease levels of anxiety. What does anxiety look like in a rat anyway? Rats are nocturnal creatures, and they don't like bright lights. And you put them in this arena where it's dark around the periphery and it's brightly lit in the middle, and you put something wonderful in the middle, some piece of food or whatever, and the rat wants it, but it's made anxious by the bright lights, and you see this coming and going vacillation, and higher levels of anxiety, the rat is less capable of leaving that safe wall. So manipulate the amygdala in a rat and you manipulate levels of anxiety. Remarkably, you give a rat an anti-anxiety drug called a benzodiazepine, and that's a term that came up many lectures ago, a drug like Valium or Librium, and the rat gets less anxious and is more willing to explore the middle of that arena and has an amygdala that isn't as active. What about the human amygdala? You can't do that experimental stuff, but some accidents of nature, some very rare cases where people have had their two amygdalas, there's one on each side, their two amygdalas damaged, and these are individuals who don't show fear. These are individuals who are bizarrely trusting in circumstances where one should be a little bit skeptical and cautious. So the amygdala has a similar tone in humans. Now, how do you see just how an amygdala is working? And the sort of studies you do, once again, brain imaging, put someone in one of those images. In this case, you can see what circumstances make a part of the brain suddenly become metabolically active. With the amygdala, it's fearful stimuli. It's stimuli that you've learned to perceive as fearful, and in fact, they could be subliminal, that whole business where you flash up a scary picture for a tenth of a second, and you're not even aware that you saw it. Your cortex isn't even aware that it saw it. Your amygdala did. And one of the things you wind up seeing is people with post-traumatic stress disorder, their amygdala can get bigger or more metabolically active. So what does stress have to do with this? On a purely behavioral level, stress increases anxiety. And you can show this with laboratory rats. Glucocorticoids do the same, and it's got lots to do with the amygdala. What were our hotspots so far of glucocorticoid receptors? Hippocampus, frontal cortex, next in line is the amygdala. Extremely sensitive to glucocorticoids. So what happens there with sustained stress? Really interesting. Back to the hippocampus. Lots of stress, lots of glucocorticoids, and the hippocampus doesn't do its job as well. The synapses are less excitable, less of that LTP stuff. The dendrites, the processes of neurons retract, all of that. Meanwhile, over in the amygdala right next door, it's exactly the opposite. Lots of stress, lots of glucocorticoids, and the amygdala gets better at doing what it does, which is learning to be afraid. And the amygdala has its synapses, its connections, become more excitable. And the amygdala will even grow new processes. The neurons will get larger, more interconnected. And what we see here is stress remarkably doing on a nuts and bolts level exactly the opposite of what it does in the hippocampus. But on the most fundamental level, it sets you up again for another psychiatric disorder. Now, this brings us into another realm where things can go wrong and where you pay a psychiatric price and where stress has something to do with it, hostility. Hostility. Hostility, way back when, used to go under the name of type A personality. Type A was first described by a pair of cardiologists in San Francisco in the 1950s, Friedman and Roseman, and here was the original type A formulation. Time-pressured, impatient, low self-esteem, joyless striving, anger, and this was what the picture was. And what these guys reported at the time was, if this was your personality profile, you were more at risk for heart disease. Type A personality, increasing the risk of cardiovascular disease. Cardiologists hated these guys. You're some 1950s cardiologist, and all you think about is like heart valves and lipid levels in the bloodstream. And here's these guys saying, no, you got to sit down with your patients and talk to them and find out how they feel about their life. They hated the concept, total resistance to it. And it wasn't until the 1980s enough studies had been done to make clear that the type A personality profile was for real in terms of increasing the risk of heart disease. It was, in fact, a bigger risk factor than if you smoked, than if you were overweight, than if you had elevated cholesterol levels, hugely endangering factor. By the 1980s, what became clear, though, was the critical component of that type A profile, which was the hostility. The hostility of a certain style, what's now known as toxic hostility, and this attributional style where anything that happens around you is proof that they're out to get you, they're out to get you preferentially, all you can do is watch your back 24/7, and this is the style. This is the style where you're in the supermarket and you've picked the slower line, and you want to kill the son of a bitch kid behind the cash register, intentionally slowing you down. And no, don't ask the old lady how she is today. And come on, I'm going to die someday and I want to spend my whole life on supermarket lines. This is your interpretive style instead of checking out the People magazines there. And your blood pressure is going to go up and you will put yourself more at risk for cardiovascular disease. And in a lot of ways, the central research question of what toxic hostility is about is, insofar as you are toxically hostile, what's worse for your cardiovascular system? Expressing the hostility or keeping it repressed inside? And what's clear is expressing it is worse for everybody else's blood pressure, but this is a big issue. What is the physiological cost of repressing strong emotions? So really fascinating. What's also fascinating is the story of how type A personality was first discovered. And I got this from the horse's mouth some years ago. Meyer Friedman, the cardiologist who first described it, died a few years ago at age 91. He saw his last patient a week before he died working full-time cardiology clinic. As he used to say, I still have type A personality, but I'm a type A tortoise now. So here's the story he would tell. 1950s, he and his partner had this new cardiology practice. Everything was going fine. They had this one problem, though, which was, for some weird reason, the armchairs in the waiting room were getting worn out at a very high rate. What's this about? Who knows what this is about? This is part of the overhead. Every month, this upholsterer would come and would have to fix a couple of chairs, and that's how it works. One month, the upholsterer is on vacation, in comes a replacement upholsterer, takes one look at the chairs, and discovers type A personality, who says, what's with your patients? Nobody wears our chairs this way. And that was indeed the case. The front 2 inches of the seat cushion and the front 2 inches of the armrest were totally shredded, like beavers were in there every night pulling away at the chairs. This is the type A profile, the person who is not just figuratively, but literally sitting on the edge of their seat and squirming and clawing nervously. This is what a type A individual looks like when they have heart disease, sitting in the office of their cardiologist. This is what it was. So what happens next? This is where things get really unfortunate. How should things have occurred? At that point, Friedman should grab the guy of like, good God, man, what you've discovered, or like, upholsterers having midnight meetings with the cardiologists, or teams of young idealistic upholsterers sweeping across America and coming back with the news that, no, you don't find chairs like these in podiatrists' offices. That didn't happen. What happens instead, here's where Dr. Friedman starts looking all sheepish. He said, I told my nurse, get this man out of my face. I'm this important cardiologist. He's wasting my time. Give him his damn check. He was too type A to listen to the guy. And it was about 5 years later that Friedman was collaborating with some psychologists, and out popped the type A profile. And they said, oh my God, the upholsterer, he was right. To this day, nobody has a clue who that man was. So this stands as one of the truly dark chapters in the history of science and medicine. Okay, moving on. Another realm and intersection between personality and stress. And this is a fascinating personality profile. And this isn't even a disease. It's a personality style. These are people who have what is termed repressive personalities. Maybe 5% of the population fits this profile. By definition, if you are repressive, you don't have a depression, you don't have an anxiety disorder, those have to get cleared out. And in fact, you tend to be really happy. And you claim that you're happy, and they can even prove that you're happy with little psychological tests. And who are these people like, these repressive personality individuals? These are the folks who are so organized. These are the people who have everything under control. These are the folks who cross all their T's and dot their I's. They've got everything organized. These are the folks who walk the same way to work every single day. They can tell you what they're having for dinner 2 weeks from Thursday. These are folks who were like that. These are the people, like the college roommate you had, where you looked at them and you said, oh God, I wish I had like even remotely as much discipline as this person does. They get tons accomplished. Everything is terrific. Until something stressful comes along. Until something of a particular type of stressor, which is some ambiguity. And they don't like surprises. They're not good with surprises. They don't express emotions very readily. They repress them. They don't read subtle emotions in other people very readily. And they're able to recognize the big ones. Oh, this person is in a rage and that person is euphoric. They can't pick up this person is a rage but has an undercurrent of melancholy. The secondary emotions they don't express and they don't pick up very well. So there are some downsides to it. But nonetheless, these are people who are normally highly functional, doing well, very productive and happy. So what are we doing talking about them in a stress course? What are we doing? You go find something interesting. Look at how their bodies work. First interesting hint. You look at the prefrontal cortex. Put them in one of those scanners and you can see the level of activity in the prefrontal cortex. And you ask, what's the levels of activity there? Prefrontal cortex, it's the part of the brain that makes you do the harder thing when it's the right thing to do. Long-term planning, gratification, postponement. It's got repressive disciplined personality written all over it. People with repressive personalities, the level of metabolism in their prefrontal cortexes are elevated above normal. What is that? It's like their frontal cortex is spending all the time squeezing their psychic sphincters close as tight as possible. This is the regulation. And what about hormones? And you look in the bloodstream of these folks, and what you see is elevated levels of glucocorticoids. This makes no sense at all. This makes no sense because these people aren't depressed, they aren't anxious, they're happy, they're productive. What are they doing with elevated glucocorticoid levels? And I think what repressives tell us is something very interesting, which is sometimes it could be enormously stressful to create a world in which nothing stressful ever occurs. So here we've seen yet another realm in which stress is bad news. You want to get rid of it. We've got all our organ systems. We've got these psychiatric disorders. We even have the ones that aren't psychiatric disorders that look like a good deal. But nonetheless, there's chronic activation of the stress response, repressive individuals. And this just underlines our theme of stress, bad news, get rid of this stuff, get rid of every type of stressor. What's worth talking about right now is that's not how it works. The goal of research in this area, the goal of any of this, is not to get rid of stress. We don't want lives without stress whatsoever. In fact, we love stress. We love stress when it's the right kind. We leap up to experience it. We pay good money to get terrified by some scary movie. It's not that you don't want stress. We want the right kind, and that's clearly apparent in all sorts of realms of life. What do we call the right kind of stress? We call it stimulation. And you look at somebody who works with child development, and the goal is not to have a stress-free life. You need stimulation. You look at gerontologists, and the exact same punchline there. Our goal is not to have stress-free lives. We love stress when it's the right kind, when it's stimulatory. So what counts as stimulatory stress? When is stress in the perfect range? And it has a couple of parameters to it. First off, it's a moderate stressor. Here's the example. You get on a roller coaster, and this counts as wonderful active stimulatory stress that you want to experience. You get on a roller coaster, and part of going on there is you're expecting, you know, unpleasant things to happen to your body as part of it, and maybe by the end of it, you're going to feel a little queasy and nauseous, and that's part of the stressful menace of getting on a roller coaster. You may feel queasy afterward. You don't get on a roller coaster where there's a fairly high probability that you're going to be decapitated instead. You want a moderate challenge there. You want a moderate menace. What else? What else that are aspects of when stress is working just right? It's transient. It doesn't go on for too long. What you got there is the same logic. It's not by chance that roller coaster rides are 3 minutes long and not 3 weeks long. So you want transient stuff. And most importantly, you want to feel those experiences, that transient challenge, that moderate challenge, in a context that's safe, where overall you are in a benevolent setting. So we've just defined something very interesting. A benevolent setting where you are willing to stress yourself, as long as it's not too severe and doesn't go on for too long, where you are willing to stress yourself by giving up a certain degree of control, of predictability, of outlets, all of that. What if we just defined this is what play is? Play is giving up control in a circumstance where you feel safe. Look at two dogs when they're playing. What happens? The higher ranking one squats down low, takes the subordinate position, saying, hey, the hierarchy is suspended for the moment, and I'm willing to take this position because we are going to play. We're going to play. And what you do then is you give up all the control, predictability that the subordinate animal has to make sure the dominant one knows they're groveling. And they're rolling around, and they're communicating vulnerability. And before you know it, you're allowing the other dog to put his teeth on your neck and your private parts and all. This is what play is. Play is the world in which, in an overall benevolent setting, we're willing to give up some control. We're willing to be stressed. And we love play. And an absence of play is a very serious problem during development and probably during adulthood as well. So we're in this terrain now of stress, not being stressful, but under the right parameters, stress being pleasurable. Where does this come in? What does go on in the brain that begins to explain it? And we are back to that neurotransmitter that has already been floating around a lot in these lectures, dopamine. Dopamine, you remember dopamine, the pleasure pathway. Dopamine is about reward. Turns out when you look more closely, dopamine isn't actually about reward. It's about the anticipation of reward. It's not about happiness. It's about the pursuit of happiness. And it's even about the motivation, the willingness to work that comes out of that anticipation in order to get the reward. Very insightful work showing dopamine is more about anticipation than it is about the actual reward. And I knew somebody in my dorm in college, an extremely mordant, depressive sort of guy, who summed this up very well once by saying, a relationship is the price you pay for the anticipation of it. You know, this guy had an endless string of disastrous relationships, but you get the point here. Dopamine is much more about anticipation, the pursuit of, than it is about the actual reward. So we've now gotten some more insight as to what dopamine has to do with this. So where has dopamine come in before? Wait, we heard about dopamine before in the depression lecture. Chronic stress depletes you of dopamine. And thus you have less of a capacity for pleasure, for the anticipation of pleasure. You become anhedonic. That's not what short-term stress does. What happens with moderate amounts of stress that's moderately transient, with moderate increases in glucocorticoid levels, you increase the release of dopamine from out of those pathways. Short-term stress improves all those aspects of mood. Short-term stress activates those reward pathways. And where are we? We're back to our starting premise of all of this stuff. Short-term stress response does something extremely different from long-term. We've already seen short-term enhances cognition and more oxygen delivery to the brain and all that sort of stuff. And short-term stress releases dopamine. That's great. That's wonderful. And it's sufficiently so that you will see there are optimal levels of glucocorticoids in the bloodstream, which stay up to just the right amount for just the right duration in order to maximize dopamine release. And an absolutely remarkable finding, which is you take lab rats and you put them in a position where, by pressing a lever, they can get infused with a certain amount of glucocorticoids. Oh my God, that's terrible. Glucocorticoids, don't do that, don't do that. It's going to cause a gazillion diseases. And what you see is lab rats will press the levers to the point to get the exact level of glucocorticoids in the bloodstream that maximize the release of dopamine. So what we've seen here is this transition from stress being uniformly bad news and glucocorticoids being the steroid of Beelzebub and that sort of thing to this whole world, we love the right kind of stress. And we call it stimulation, and just the right amount of glucocorticoids going hand in hand with that, and we secrete more dopamine rather than less. So this brings us now to the realm of individuals, where that whole process of pleasure and excitement and stimulation and anticipation works kind of differently from everybody else. These are the folks who need enormous amounts of challenge and stress and menace and all of that to get things going. What are we defining here? Adrenaline junkies. And as we've learned something about the biology of them, what's become obvious is it's the wrong term. They shouldn't be called adrenaline junkies. They should be called dopamine junkies. And what's happening with them? Animal models of this, okay, not adrenaline junkie rats, but thrill-seeking, risk-taking, that sort of thing, that you could define. What's going on biologically? First hints of two different things. One is, as we saw just now, with the onset of a transient stressor, a transient stimulus, you go up with dopamine, and then you go back down. These rats who are models of adrenaline junkies, they go up, and they go back down a little lower than where they started. And thus they have to do it again with a stronger stimulus. And they go back even lower, and over, because you're habituating to what's going on. Or other evidence suggests there's different versions, different genetic versions of dopamine receptors, some of which are less responsive. You need more of an oomph in the system to keep it from habituating. And to appreciate this, think about this. Who's that guy? Evel Knievel? That was that madman who would motorcycle over all sorts of, like, cruisers and things of that sort and had broken every bone in his body over and over. And you think about it, once a long, long time ago, the young Evel Knievel, who had his driver's permit in his back pocket, raced a red light and just got across in time and got a little bit of a thrill from that. And the next day, that wasn't enough. So what this begins to bring up here, of course, is the issue of stress and addiction. And they're highly intertwined in all sorts of ways. When you are highly addicted to a drug, cocaine, for example, which releases dopamine, what you find is you down-regulate, you decrease the number of dopamine receptors, so you've got to release more and more of the stuff to get the same buzz in the system, and dopamine is released in massive amounts in response to some of the dopamine-related drugs like cocaine, amphetamines, things of that sort. So you've got this happening here. And the question becomes, at what point do you have this transition from wanting to have a drug to needing to have the drug? At what point does the addictiveness kick in? And what you see is it's around the point where you're getting a lower and lower baseline after each one of these. You're habituating to the drug, where the receptors that might be kind of sluggish in their response are getting even more sluggish. You're decreasing the numbers of them. And suddenly, you've moved from drug abuse as recreational wanting to addiction, needing. And it's right around that point that taking these drugs were associated with very high levels of glucocorticoids, and even more so, craving those drugs and not getting them are associated with astronomically high levels. So what does stress do to the system? Absolutely logical things. You take rats, and what you'll do is they have this task. They can press a lever a certain number of times to get an infusion of a tiny amount of cocaine, for example. It's called self-administration. Stress a rat, and it self-administers more cocaine. Stress a rat, and is willing to work harder to get that dopamine buzz because it's beginning to get a little bit depleted of dopamine. Another subtle thing as well, which is, often you see individuals who have a history of some addiction and they're basically cured of it. They're on the wagon and they're doing just fine. And what a standard view in the field is, there's no such thing as, for example, an ex-alcoholic. There's only alcoholics who are not drinking at this point, because part of what you see is this phenomenon called relapse. You take someone who hasn't taken drugs in whatever number of years, who hasn't drunk to excess, whatever, and they've been fine and going along with their life, and you put them back in the place where they used to take the drugs, or they used to drink too much, back on that street corner, or back in that big comfortable armchair in their men's club, whatever it is, and suddenly the craving comes roaring back, you relapse. And what also occurs is lots of stress, and you relapse more readily. In lab rats and in humans as well, of course, there's individual differences in it, and there's increasing insight that it's going to have differences in the types of dopamine receptors and all that sort of thing. And there's some evidence that people who have more addictive personalities tend to secrete glucocorticoids longer after a stressor. We're beginning to get a lot of insight there. And somewhere in there, there's a really fascinating issue, because all of this revolves around dopamine. And dopamine and that reward pathway with the generating of anticipation, it's talking an awful lot to the frontal cortex and getting the frontal cortex all aerobically stoked up to do the harder thing. Dopamine has a really large challenge because there's a wide range of things that are pleasurable to us. Once, 500 years ago, some medieval peasant hearing an organ cathedral, that was like the loudest man-made sound in their entire life. It must have been just overwhelming, the emotions it pulled out. Now, we've got so many big, raucous, thundering things that a cathedral organ seems like this quaint little thing. Once, there were hunter-gatherers who would strike gold somewhere in the forest there, or they would find a beehive that they could get a hold of, and they got the greatest of pleasures. They got some honey. And now, these days, you go into a market, and there's hundreds of products that have been carefully engineered by smart scientists to flood our taste buds with far more sugary momentness than some honey in a forest could ever bring about. Or you have some task which, amid a very difficult, demanding life of all sorts of privations, you accomplish something, and that's pleasurable. And you release some dopamine, and now instead, you take an artificial drug and you release a thousandfold as much. The only way this dopamine system could handle this, where pleasure could take the form of the whiff of flowers at spring all the way up to a massive amount of cocaine, the only way this system could work is it habituates quickly. And that's the only way in which you can have a massive source of pleasure one day and you can have a dopamine response 2 days later to something as subtle as the right person brushing your arm. And what we have is one very sad outcome to this unique range that we humans have of feeling pleasure. One very sad outcome, this ability of the dopamine system to habituate so quickly, which is for those feelings of pleasure to habituate so quickly. And if we were simply machines of homeostatic balance, the more we consumed, the less we would need. And instead, the more we consume, the more we want. And whatever was exciting yesterday is what you expect today and isn't going to be enough tomorrow.
Lecture 22, Stress, Health, and Low Social Status.
Well, we are now continuing this large arc that this course is basically set up. For the first dozen or so lectures, maybe a few more than that, the primary concern was the biology of the stress response, the biology of stress-related disease, when it's good news, when it's bad news, all of that. And in the recent set of lectures, somewhere around the point transitioning to what makes psychological stress stressful, we went into a second phase, bringing up a critical truism that ran through all those lectures, which is you can't begin to understand the biology of disease outside of the context of the person in whom that biology is happening. With this lecture now, we transition to a third layer. A third layer in this case, ever more expansive, saying not only can you not understand the biology of disease outside the context of the person in which the biology is occurring, but also in addition to outside the context of the society in which that individual dwells. And what this lecture is about is looking at what your place in society has to do with your health, and as we'll see, is a strongly intervening variable, what your place in society has to do with what sort of stressors you're exposed to. Now, following a time-honored rule, starting with a subject this complex, I'm going to start off talking about animals and what hierarchy has to do with health. And I'm going to start off talking about baboons. And I've studied baboons in East Africa on and off for about 30 years, and I've been interested in stress-related disease, who gets the diseases, who doesn't, what does it have to do with social behavior. And if you're interested in stress and disease, psychogenic stress, baboons are perfect to study because they're totally untrustworthy, backstabbing, miserable creatures. Okay, here's the deal with baboons. If you're a baboon and you live in the Serengeti ecosystem, which is the animals I study, it is a fabulous place to live. The baboons there, infant survival rate is better than among neighboring humans. You live in these big troops, so the predators don't mess with you much. And most importantly, you only have to work about 3 hours a day for your calories. Critical implication. If you only have to work 3 hours a day for your calories, that means you've got like 9 hours of free time every day to devote to being just god-awful to some other baboon. All they do is harass each other. All they do is generate stress in each other. Overwhelmingly, if you're a baboon in the Serengeti and you're miserable, it's because another baboon has worked really hard to bring that state about. They're perfect models for us westernized humans. They are no more getting stressed running away from lions than we are. Instead, they have the capacity to generate psychosocial stress. Now, an awful lot of what this stress is built around is dominance hierarchy. Baboons come with dominance ranks. There's a number 1, a number 10, a number 20, and this greatly influences the quality of your life. And what I've been interested in over the years out there is, what does your dominance rank have to do with how your body responds to stress? And with a great deal of work over the years, I got what I thought was a very clear answer, which is, if you have the choice in the matter, you do not want to be a low-ranking baboon, because you get all sorts of grief. You dig some tuber out of the ground to eat, and anyone higher ranking can rip you off. You get somebody to socially groom you finally, and anybody else can disrupt it. You're sitting there minding your own business, and some guy who's in a bad mood comes and slashes your rear end with displacement aggression, lack of control, lack of predictability, lack of outlets. And what I've seen over the years is, if you are a low-ranking baboon, you see exactly the profile of poor health that one would expect. Low-ranking baboons, elevated levels of glucocorticoids, an inability to turn off the glucocorticoid stress response very effectively at the end of stress, elevated blood pressure, less of the good type of cholesterol, an immune system that doesn't quite work as well, a reproductive system that's more vulnerable to stress, anti-anxiety chemicals, these endogenous benzodiazepines, working differently over and over, you see low-ranking baboons are a wreck. And you look at this, and you come up with a perfectly obvious punchline, which is, you want to be a high-ranking baboon and go win, 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 and compete and aggress and dominate and one big social Darwinism blowout. But it turns out there's something a lot more complicated. And this is something that would come up now and then at primatology meetings I would go to. And I would get up and give a song and dance about what baboons are about with the punchline, low-ranking baboons show the greatest indices of stress-related disease. And then there'd be this guy named Dave Abbott from the University of Wisconsin who studies marmosets. These are these little squirrely monkeys that found in South America. And he would get up and say, well, among my animals, it's high-ranking animals who show the greatest indices of stress-related disease. Now, this was very uncomfortable, and mostly what we did with this was like during breaks when everybody's like jostling for the cookies there and stuff, we would avoid each other and sort of stay at different ends. But at some point, we realized we have to kind of tackle this issue, and what we started to do was try to make sense of this and look at what by that time was a dozen different species where people knew something about social rank and stress-related disease and health. And what we went through after a great deal of work and recruiting and a lot of other colleagues as well was discovering what now makes perfect sense. The relationship between rank and health, it's not so much about your rank, it's what your rank means. It's the social context of the rank. And you see all sorts of critical factors. You will see in some species, if you're a high-ranking male, for example, you get challenged 3 times a day and have to defend that rank. In other species, like baboons, for example, if you're a high-ranking male, you go months without anybody challenging you because all you need to do is like stare at somebody and it's over with. In species where the high-ranking animals are constantly being challenged, it's the high-ranking individuals who have the worst health. In species where the high-ranking individuals are just coasting on their laurels, it's the subordinate animals with the worst profile. More issues. You're low-ranking, and in your species, how often are you subject to displacement aggression? In other words, how often are you sitting there minding your own business and somebody pounds on you? In species where there's a lot of displacement aggression, subordinates have a worse health profile. What else? What kind of outlets do you have? And that, in the world of primates, is pretty straightforward. How often are you able to groom somebody else? In species where low-ranking animals have a lot of opportunities for grooming, their health is better than in species where the low-ranking animals don't have an opportunity. Next, what by now should make sense enormously is, so you're low-ranking in your species, according to the structure and gender organization of how your species works socially, do you have a lot of relatives in your group? Or did you pick up at puberty and go wandering over the horizon and join a troop where you got no relatives? The more relatives subordinate animals have in their species, the healthier they are. So this was really quite a striking finding for us. It's not rank, it's what your rank means. Another factor, how stable is your rank? If you are a high-ranking individual and you're having lots of unstable interactions with a rival, you're going to have lousy stress profile. If you have extremely stable, predictable ones, you're really healthy, over and over this theme. And very quickly, what you see is you can take this even one step further, rather than looking at different primate species where there's enormous differences in social organization. I mean, huge, huge variation. You begin to look at individual social groups of primates of the same species, and they have differences. In this troop, the alpha male is a misery and beats on everyone. In that troop, the alpha male spends all his time meditating and grooming. And what you see is the particular social atmosphere of your troop is a predictive feature of what does your rank have to do with your health. In some species and in some primate groups, it's better being subordinate than in other cases. You get more or less grief. So all of this winds up being really interesting and leads one immediately to say, well, what's up with humans? And of course, the first question here is, do humans have ranks in the way that these other primates do? Now, I'm very skeptical about this possibility, mainly because I spent my entire childhood being the last one picked for the wiffle ball teams, and thus, I'm not quite sure if we are a ranked hierarchical species. We're much more complicated than that. We have hierarchies, but one of the things we have going for us is we belong to multiple hierarchies. And what happens is, belong to enough of them, and even though you may be at the bottom of a whole bunch of them, there's going to be one where you're doing well. And that's the one that you rationalize into being the most important. So you've got somebody who is downtrodden in some miserable job where they're highly subordinated, but come the weekend, they're the captain of the softball team. And you better bet that's the person who's going to be sitting there saying, 9 to 5, you've got to earn a living, but it's stupid. That's just, you know, bringing home the bacon. And what's important in life is when Saturday comes along. What we have a great ability to do is play psychological games with whatever our rank is in particular hierarchies. And often, what we can also do is play games with not so much what your rank is, but what it used to be, what direction you're heading. So we're not a ranked species in the way that all sorts of these primates are. We've got a lot more subtle stuff going on. Nonetheless, there's one domain of human social life in westernized societies. There's one domain where there is a ranking system that is just a sledgehammer, which is socioeconomic status. Socioeconomic status, an aggregate measure of level of education, level of income, wealth of one's home, average wealth in the community you live in, this aggregate measure. And what's very obvious given this is there's a hierarchy of socioeconomic status in various societies. And on the top are the bloated robber barons, and at the bottom are the poor, and everybody